Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that engages experts in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli, and today's topic is an iconic one in the broad figurative landscape of sustainable agriculture, and that is soil health. And more precisely, we're going to talk about soil food webs. I'm thrilled to host our guest today for our inaugural podcast in Questions in Sustainability. She has earned her place as an expert in soil health worldwide, and evidence of that is her very impressive record of peer-reviewed publications and other materials in this area. Dr. Elaine Ingham, welcome to Questions in Sustainability.
Thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be here. I love to talk about soil food webs, so this is right up my alley.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes, so I mentioned your distinguished journal publication record, and you've done some interesting studies that I may go back on if we have some time, but I want to mention something about your bio for our listeners. And so you have a bachelor's in biology and chemistry, it's from St. Olaf College, master's in microbiology from Texas A&M, PhD in microbiology from Colorado State University. You are the founder and president of Soil Food Web Inc. and the director of Soil Food Web School. So really, you've really thought about this topic for a long time. Maybe we could start by asking you, what is the soil food web?
Well, the soil food web is that set of microorganisms in the soil that perform most of the processes. If you want to change something in your soil, you need to be understanding what organisms perform those functions, because it's those organisms that will do the work. You know, it's like in building soil structure. You have to have something making the glues. Well, that something is bacteria for the most part, making the glues that hold all the small particles, the clays, the maybe the silts, maybe some of the sands, certainly some of the smaller particles of organic matter, hold that together and you form micro aggregates. Well, when you do that, now you open up space where oxygen and water and roots can move through. And then the fungi come along, and with their hyphae, they pull those micro aggregates together, building larger air passageways and hallways for the organisms and water and roots to grow down through the soil, kind of the way they're supposed to. So it's all those organisms in the soil, bacteria, fungi, protozoa, nematodes, microarthropods, earthworms, incotraeads, spiders, you know, you can go on and on of that whole trophic scheme and start to understand who eats who and why that's important to plants.
So I think what your comments highlight for me is the fact that you've got to think about the soil in multiple sort of physical dimensions and scales because of the different sizes and different processes that you described. So my wife, I asked her a question, and I was going to bring it in towards the end, but I almost think it fits right now. And she asked, I said, what do you want to most know about the soil food web? And she said, what is it that we can most do to promote the soil food web, and why is that important?
You want to take all the indigenous organisms that you possibly can get your hands on, which means going out and collecting very small samples of every kind of condition that you can find, except, of course, the really bad ones. You don't want diseases or pests, so avoid the anaerobic parts of your landscape, including the soilscape, if you will. You want to collect all the beneficial organisms. So you're going to collect from, well, forests are really very good places to go and get some of the O horizon, maybe some of the A horizon, slightly different sets of microorganisms present. You want to go to wood chip piles. You want to go to the organic matter layer in your pastures or your grasslands. So all the different kinds of places, from the pond, you want to collect all those organisms. And then you want to inoculate that into a compost pile where you're going to make certain the conditions are going to select for the beneficial sets of microorganisms, which means basically you have to keep it aerobic as much as possible through that whole composting process. Now you've got choices with compost. You can do thermal composting where you're going to rely on temperature occurring in the pile, and that temperature is strictly due to how fast are the microorganisms growing. The faster the bacteria and fungi, protozoa and nematodes are reproducing in that pile, the higher the temperature is going to get in a very short period of time. Well, how is it that you manage to do that? You put in the right kinds of foods to make certain that the microorganisms will be reproducing very rapidly. And so we get into recipes for your pile. Now, we can also do worm composting, where the worms are going to do most of the mixing and turning for you, where you don't have to do the pitchfork story that you've got to deal with a thermal compost. Let the worms do the work for you, and they will incorporate the organic matter. They will bring in their own inoculum of microorganisms, but you still want to add the local indigenous species of good guys into your worm bin. And then you do need to make certain that your worm bin doesn't go anaerobic in any place. And then of course we can talk about static composting, but I usually leave discussions about static composting until people have been making compost either through thermal processes or through earthworm compost. I want at least 2 years under people's belts before they start doing static composting. It's just that quantitatively much more difficult.
So you mentioned the importance of the local microorganisms. I think I can probably take a stab at why that is important, but I'd rather hear you describe. Yeah, I think you've got the perspective and the broader landscape on this. So why the local microorganisms?
You don't want to be introducing anything that could become a pathogen. That you know isn't going to be controlled. It doesn't have a predator. It doesn't have some restriction. And you bring something that is completely new to this environment, the greatest likelihood is it's not going to be able to survive if there are enough of the indigenous organisms to compete with, inhibit, and consume that alien invader. But every once in a while, we bring in something that can survive perfectly well under especially in the agricultural systems that we set up that they're so lacking in the organisms, the local indigenous organisms, that something takes over and becomes a horrible disease. There's just hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of organisms being brought in from outside where they become pathogens. And, the plague happens and then the system starts, responding to, and eventually we'll get that pathogenic organism under control, but it can take, again, a millennia or two. Nature doesn't care. She'll get around to it. Don't fuss, don't muss. She'll take care of it. But in terms of a human lifespan, she has a much broader attitude about these things.
So this kind of issue where you would get the introduction of a non-indigenous organism that could develop wildly and create unexpected problems, that is the result. Now, these are my words, so I want to see, how they fit with yours. But that would be the result, basically, of a soil that's not biologically buffered. Is that a good way to think of it?
That is lacking in some set of organisms that would compete with and consume and prevent that alien invader from being able to invade. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that makes sense. So, this makes eminent sense. I go back to my days in graduate school where I took a course in soil microbiology with Martin Alexander. And so what a thrill. And he expected a lot of us and we had to work hard, but some of these things kind of go back to that the early days of microbiology for me, soil microbiology. So I'm sort of switching this interview around on the fly, but I'm curious with the knowledge that we have about these soil food webs and your experiences in manipulating and improving the soil food web and making it more robust and more biologically buffered. How is that information used by growers?
What we want to do is look at what is in there. Most of the time it's dirt, it's not soil. And, you know, we maybe need to go over that definition of dirt versus soil before I finish answering. You'll probably have to remind me that we were.
Okay.
So when we're looking at that difference between dirt and soil, dirt is just the mineral component, the sand, the silt, the clay, the rocks, the pebbles, boulders, parent material. That's dirt. It doesn't have the organic matter, and it doesn't have the sets of microorganisms in that mineral material. And it's surprising to me that, like in the engineering world, they are always looking at soil texture. They're not looking at soil. They define soil as being percent sand, silt, and clay. No, that can't be soil. That's dirt.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the organisms. You don't have foods to keep those organisms alive. So Hans Jenny, one of the fathers of soil science, defines soil as being the mineral component. Yep, the sand, the silt, the clay, rocks, da-da-da. The organisms, because the organisms do all the work of converting that dirt into something that's got structure, that's got nutrient cycling going on and retention and infiltration, your roots, the plant. Well, but you still have to get the biology balanced correctly for the specific plant that you're going to grow. So soil in general is the mineral, the organic matter, and the organisms. You have to have the organic matter in there because microorganisms have to eat. They're just like human beings. They must be consuming vast quantities in order to stay alive, in order to reproduce. So all three components have to be present for it to really be called soil.
Go ahead. I interrupted you.
So it's, so we, yeah, I was going to, yeah, I, sorry. I lost the chain.
No, sorry about that. But I do want to reflect on that. I've been in agricultural sciences for 40 years, something like that, and including graduate school. And I've never heard that definition. And it makes sense that we distinguish the soil with its multifactorial components from the mineral portion, which is what you call dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mineral portion doesn't change. It doesn't alter. And one of the interesting things I've been seeing is that as we go around the world and we start out on pure sand or we start out on pure clays, and we start getting the biology back in, we get the organic matter. Organic matter must get above 3% if you want to ever be able to kind of let the system go on its own and continue to grow and improve as nature would through that process of succession. So we start out with something that you can't grow a crop on it, basically, because it's pure sand or pure clay. It's going to have no water holding capacity, or it's going to have too much water holding capacity, compacts dramatically, and now you can't grow anything. You've got to take that biology with that organic matter, get it into the soil, get these organisms performing all of their functions. And with as short as a year, one growing season, we can convert those extremes into something that behaves like a good loam. And it is only through the actions of these microorganisms, getting the good aerobic organisms back into the system, that we can make a soil that behaves like a good, wonderful, rich loam, same color, same abilities as a loam. You can't tell the difference. And yet when I bring USDA agents out and say, okay, look at this gorgeous loam. Remember when I showed you this field last spring in April, May, and it was pure clay. You'll never be able to grow anything in here. So now here we are, it's a loam. And they say, where did you find a good loam? And did you, where did you take the clay that you must have dug up out of this field? And you put it someplace else and you brought in this loam. And I kind of just look at them like, there is no loam for sale in this state. You've got to make your own. And we can do that. They're just so lacking in the understanding of what biology can do for growing your plants that they assume that we had to have gone out and spent $1 million or more to get rid of the clay and put in this nice, beautiful loam. No, we can build it ourselves if you understand what the biology is in the soil. So we always go out and we measure what's in your soil. How bad is it? And if you've been following a chemical agricultural approach, you have nothing except the disease-causing bacteria left in that. Well, it's dirt. You do have some life in there, but you don't have the organic matter typically. And you'd have those sets of organisms that are utterly the things you do not want. Now, how do you fix that? We're going to come along with very rich organic material that we have put all these beneficial organisms back into. And we have assured that as long as you stay aerobic, it'll be the good guys that are growing and not the diseases, not the pests, not the problem organisms. So I sort of look at those things that allow us to call something dirt are the same things that Mother Nature uses to warn you that you are taking your soil and converting it into dirt. You're destroying the biology. You cannot have the functions. You cannot have the fertility. You're going to lose your nutrients. It's going to leach out the bottom. You're going to be growing just bad guys. So how do you turn that around? You get the good guys back into the soil.
So what would the, I mean, I know this is part of the work that you do currently, and that is help growers identify food web structures and so on. What are some of the indicators that that clue you or a farmer into the fact that you've got a robust or not so robust food web in your soils?
One of the simplest things to do is to take a metal rod and start pushing it into the soil. And as soon as you have any difficulty pushing that metal rod into the soil, you've got a compaction layer now at that depth. So you can find out where, at what depth is that, that will not allow the roots of most plants to be able to grow through it. Work done at Penn State for years have been showing that at that point in your soil, it's 150 PSI, pounds per square inch pressure that you have to apply in order to push that metal rod through. And most root systems cannot push their way through something that is compacted more than 150 PSI. You can push through, you know, sometimes I have a problem, but I just go get one of my graduate students that's young enough still. They get it pushed through. When you hit 300 PSI and you can't possibly move that metal rod through the soil once you hit, 300, 400 PSI, but there are no roots of any plant that can push its way through a soil that is compacted more than 300 PSI. It's got to look for a crack. It's got to look for a crevice. And if you're talking about an agricultural field that has been abused by destroying the biology in that soil so you can't build that structure. And as water puddles and it goes anaerobic in that soil, you're only growing diseases and pests. You're not going to be able to grow a crop in that plant, in that field. So that's one very easy way of figuring out if you've got a problem, and then you know exactly where that problem is and whether you should be injecting this really beneficial sets of organisms down that deep into the soil, or you want to use like a key line plow or a moldboard or a yeoman's plow or something like that, where you're injecting the liquid biology from your compost pile and getting that into the soil to inoculate the organisms that can at least start to build your structure in that soil again.
So, so that's a really interesting way to judge the health of the soil is the metal rod. Are there other things that, I mean, there must be other things, right?
So what? Sure. Look at the color of your soil, especially where you dig down and you get to the sea horizon. There's not a lot of organic matter once you get down that far, typically. There is organic matter in there. But when you compare that sea horizon, kind of the color of the parent material, and compare that to the color of your O horizon, your A horizon, B horizon, you'll see that as you up at the top where that organic matter is being decomposed, there's a lot of very complex compounds that are being built. The metabolites that are being released by the microorganisms are going to be condensed into ever more structurally complex material, which causes that brown color, that nice, beautiful, rich 70% cocoa color, brown, to that soil. So your O horizon should be that color. Of course, during the year, there's going to be bacteria and fungi and protozoa and nematodes are all being eaten by their predators. And so some of those nutrients are going to get washed down into the soil a little bit deeper, and that's the A horizon then. Okay, what color is the A horizon? Do you have a really good set of complex food resources for the microorganisms so that this massive diversity of bacteria and fungi and protozoa and nematodes, microarthropods, earthworms, et cetera, will be able to live in your soil, and you're going to get the diversity that you require to do all of the functions at all of the temperatures under your typical seasonal sets of cycles. Are they there or not? Well, you're not going to be able to build that beautiful color if you don't have the full food web present in your soil. So start looking at color. And as you're digging up the different layers of your soil and comparing it to your sea horizon and going, gosh, I'm here in the A horizon and there's not much color difference between my A and my C, you're in trouble. You don't have the foods to feed the organisms to build structure, to build that soil back. So that's another good way. And as you're digging down into your soil and you're bringing back, troughs full or shovels full of your soil and you're going, what is that smell? Oh my God, rotten eggs, putrefaction, vomit smells, all of the indicators of anaerobic conditions. Okay. Those highly stinky, smelly compounds are only produced by anaerobic microorganisms in anaerobic conditions. And if you've got those anaerobic conditions, you've got diseases and pests. Mm-hmm. So you don't want, let's get some oxygen down here. How are you going to do that? Well, a lot of times when people have been in chemical agriculture for a long time, and they have absolutely nothing good left in their soil, I'm going to say, put a good layer of compost out there with all the right microorganisms and till it in. Yep. Every time you till, you are going to be killing 50% of the species of organisms. You're going to be dropping the amount of fungi and protozoa and nematodes, but at least you're getting half. 50% of what was in that good compost has gotten deep down into your soil. And now these microorganisms can start building structure down however deep you could till that material into the soil. It's a good start. But then as soon as you can, you want to come back in with a liquid application, and maybe you'll inject it deeper down into the soil, or maybe you'll just put it in the furrow where you're planting your seeds, or where you're dropping your starts, or where you're planting your orchard trees. You want to be putting those sets of organisms into those places so that you can start seeing this change in the structure of the soil. If you put down the metal rim and you look at how fast does infiltration happen, you can see the change on a weekly basis. If your organisms are growing, if you've altered the conditions in that dirt enough to allow these beneficials to start to grow, you're going to get rid of the bad guys, and now you're starting on that process of succession to the point that you're going to match the balances of the bacteria and fungi, protozoa and nematodes, microarthropods, earthworms, etc. You're going to balance those correctly for the plant that you're trying to grow. And so there's this whole successional process that we now need to understand. And all of succession is driven by the microorganisms in the soil. The change in the sets of microorganisms has to happen first. And then succession can move along in the, the classic, what is it, Hutchins, who did that, the first explanation of what succession is, what the plant succession is. But that's always the movement of the plant, the change in the plant community happens as a result of changes going on in the soil, not the other way around.
Tell us more about succession.
Okay. We've been working on that question for quite some time. The first time we ever noticed this trend was when we were working at the with the Across Ecosystems study, where we were looking at how decomposable were the different litter materials in each of these different sets of succession, like shortgrass prairie, which is obviously, once it's disturbed, it's just weeds. If it's intact, it's shortgrass prairie, then you go to the tall grass prairie, high mountain meadows, and then into the young forest, medium forest, and old growth. And so across that gradient, we saw that you started out with just strictly bacterial, no structure. The only thing that grew was weeds. The only form of nitrogen was nitrate in those systems. Then as we went to the next stage of succession, we started picking up much better bacteria. The aerobic organisms were present and functioning. Soil structure was being built. We had a fungal component that we could identify. Started to get protozoa nematodes into the system as well. And noted then that the ratio of nitrate to ammonium was very high levels of nitrate, but started to have a little bit of ammonium in the system. And that was kind of interesting, because now we've got two forms of soluble inorganic nitrogen. As we moved along and looked at these same things in the next stage of succession, much better balance between bacteria and fungi when we were in a good, healthy grassland and pasture that had been overgrazed, not the fungal component present there. And as that fungal component grew, so did the pool of ammonium and nitrate reduced. It was like you could have the same amount of nitrogen present in a system, but it could be mostly nitrate, but a little bit of ammonium in that system. And as the ammonium increased, the nitrate dropped. Still the same amount of nitrogen. So if you're out there measuring total nitrogen, you're going to miss one of these things that causes succession to occur, that causes the soil to move along so you can grow more and more productive kinds of grasses, crops that we get more money for. And you don't have to be putting on the inorganic fertilizers. Just make sure your balance of fungi to bacteria is correct. Well, and if you're going to keep a balance of fungi and bacteria, then you better have a balance of the predators that eat bacteria and the predators that eat fungi. As we moved along into the high mountain meadows, even more, it was on the fungal side. As you move into the shrubs, as you move into the early, the deciduous forests, it just keeps getting more and more fungal, more and more ammonium, less and less nitrate, till you reach the old growth forest in that part of the world. It's lodgepole pine, old growth forest. You couldn't find nitrate in the soil. It just wasn't there. Because it is the fungi that control that, the fungi that produce the organic acids that drop the pH to the point where nitrate is not going to be a factor. And those are the most productive in terms of biomass of accumulation of plant material. Or if you're looking at carbon sequestration, you're going to be sequestering the greatest amount of carbon in those systems. So now we now that we've played around with this a little bit more, we can use some tricks on earlier successional systems to sequester more carbon earlier in succession. But you got to know the right organisms, and you've got to know what you're doing to get that kind of improvement, increase in gigatons of carbon being sequestered on an annual basis. So working with David Johnson, we've been putting together that kind of understanding. So
where is David?
David's at New Mexico State University.
Okay,
and he's an adjunct professor at Chico State in California. And so looking at that whole successional process, you need to determine where in that successional process, the crop that you want to grow, where does it fall? So if I want to be growing corn, I've got to understand where corn falls on that successional system. And what we see is we get the highest production of corn when we have a 1-to-1 to maybe a 2 times more fungi than bacteria ratio of fungi to bacteria. And then, of course, you have to have the protozoa and nematodes as well. And if we can get those organisms in the soil up to those levels, then we don't need to put on inorganic fertilizer, because nutrient cycling is occurring, and it is the plant that is in control of that nutrient cycling process. So how do you tell if you're in a healthy condition or not? You're going to have to look through the microscope and assess how many bacteria are you seeing in your soil, how many, what's the length and diameter of your fungi, how many protozoa do you have? Though protozoa are bacterial feeders. We need to know how many bacterial feeding nematodes, how many fungal feeding nematodes, how many predatory nematodes, how many root feeders. Root feeders are bad. You don't want them ever. How do you get rid of them? You've got to have a good food web. And in less than 2 months to 3 months, we can take a soil that has massive quantities of root feeding nematodes and basically get rid of them all to the point that they're almost undetectable in 2 to 3 months.
So this is going to be very interesting to my colleagues here in plant pathology. As you know, plant pathologists are not only plant pathologists, but many of us are mycologists as well. We study fungi, and I know you know that, but for the benefit of the audience, I'll define mycologists. So yeah, we're always interested in the good fungi. And so I have to ask a technical question. Are these generally what are called vesicular or vascular mycorrhizae? For our audience, again, these would be very small fungi, not the big mushroom producers, but the small fungi that colonize roots. Are they usually what you are referring to as the fungi grow in numbers, or is it a wider mix than that?
It's a much wider mix than that. The mycorrhizal fungi are just a small component. When you start looking at species, mm-hmm. The mycorrhizal fungi are just a teeny tiny part of that fungal mm-hmm. kingdom. Massive numbers of beneficial fungi outside the mycorrhizal. But you need mycorrhizal fungi growing in the root systems of your plants to get this highly productive system up and going. The mycorrhizal fungi are a critical component, but they are not the end all and be all.
Okay.
You cannot get the growth that you want with just mycorrhizal fungi back in your soil. You've got to get the other free-living fungi back in the soil. You don't want any oomycetes.
Okay.
And those are where most of the disease-causing fungi, well, and taxonomists are now quite happily changing all of our taxonomy, and oomycetes are going to go into a phylum all of their own. And then my leftover taxonomic knowledge just kind of goes out the window when they rearrange taxonomy quite that drastically. I don't have time to learn the new taxonomy. So I'll just keep calling them oomycetes.
Sure. Well, we're happy with that.
Great.
the oomycetes, for the audience, they're fungal-like organisms, but they but they but these would include the late blight, the organism that caused late blight in the 1840s in Ireland, sudden oak death. I mean, doesn't that sound horrible? So yeah, we don't want pretty much we want to keep the oomycetes out of healthy stack soils. Yep.
There's a few okay oomycetes that don't cause disease, at least in any system I know of, but they're not enough to try to, you know, get those guys growing. They don't compete with, consume, inhibit the other bad guys, the other oomycetes. So you want all of those ascomycetes and basidiomycetes and even some of the deuteromycetes. You want that, the rest of that diversity as well.
Yeah, very good. Okay, I know this is a topic that we could spend certainly weeks on, but you know, this is a good sort of introduction to the topic. I guess it's a good time to ask the question, what more would you like for our listeners to know? What topic have we not covered that you think should be shared?
It's probably the next most sensitive to me is when you look at the list of soil health indicators, that there's just a real dearth of knowledge or understanding of when you're doing soil respiration. Who is it that's really respiring all of that carbon? And the assumption, and a completely inaccurate assumption, is that bacteria are going to be producing 50% of that CO2 and fungi produce the other 50%. And so we don't have to care about that ratio of fungi to bacteria. They're assuming, well, you can't do that. When you look at the carbon nitrogen ratio, for example, of bacteria, 5 carbons for every 1 nitrogen. But when you look at the food that bacteria eat, simple, easy to utilize, simple to break down foods, organic material, the C-to-N ratio there is usually starts out around a C-to-N ratio of 20 to 1. That's the highest nitrogen containing material that bacteria can find. And so when those bacteria eat something that's 20 to 1, they need the concentration up at 5 to 1. That means those bacteria are going to blow off 15 carbons anytime they decompose that material. So go and look at, you know, C-to-N ratio of 30 to 1 in some of the bacterial foods. You know, that's generally the bacteria going to win on those kinds of foods in comparison to fungi. But the bacteria now are going to have to blow off 25 carbons for every nitrogen. And so look at then the fungi. So are they doing the same thing? Absolutely not. Fungi, when they utilize something that has a C to N ratio of 100 to 1 or 300 or 500 to 1, most of that carbon is laid down on the inside of the walls of those fungi. They don't blow it off as CO2 into the atmosphere. So if you want to sequester carbon, you better not be using bacteria. And yet every time you till, every time you so disturb your agricultural soil, you're going to be slicing and dicing and crushing the fungi, the protozoa, the nematodes, the microarthropods, the earthworms. You're going to be crushing all of that. And you're going to be opening up new places for the little bacteria to be able to go, whoa, look at this. We're going to take over. And that means you're going backwards in succession.
Yeah.
You're not going the direction you want to go when you're trying to grow a crop. So growers need to start to understand that it is the life in the soil that determines productivity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the physical disruption of the soil. I hear you saying, and I guess putting it in my own words, that the physical disruption of the soil from tillage is not only bad for in that it exposes microsites to decomposition, but it also disrupts the fungal and other larger microorganisms.
It takes out more of those upper levels of the food web until you're left with just bacteria. And it's, if you figure every time you till, you are going backwards in succession, how is it that weeds become such a problem in the chemical agricultural world? Because they're constantly killing all of the other things in soil. Anytime you put on an inorganic fertilizer, all inorganic fertilizers are salts. And so you're taking water away from your plant, but more importantly, you're going to be taking water away from the bacteria, fungi, protozoan, nematodes, microarthropods. And so you're killing at least 50% of the species every time you put in an inorganic fertilizer, maybe more than that, depending on what's the concentration. You know, we only put in 450 pounds per acre of nitrogen fertilizer, but when you bring in lime and gypsum to cause your soil to flocculate, you know, get air passageways in it, they're putting on 3 tons of lime per acre, half a ton of gypsum. That's the standard typical application of those salts. And they're going to be murdering all those wonderful organisms in the soil by dehydration. You're killing them. So what are you doing to your soil? You're causing it to become dirt.
Yeah.
And now you have to put those inorganic fertilizers out. Is this just not a crazy cycle here? We listen to people who are always going to be suggesting that you put on an inorganic fertilizer. And that means you're killing the very organisms that prevent diseases in the natural world. It's that massive number of bacteria around the root system, the massive mileage around that root system of the fungi. And then you have all the predators. The predators in there, quite a few of them preferentially go for the disease and pest organisms. But if you've tilled, if you've put on inorganic fertilizers, you've killed those organisms. So good luck growing your plant. You're forced to use inorganic fertilizers. And as soon as you start using inorganic fertilizers, now you're going to have problems with insect pests and diseases because you set up the conditions where water cannot move through the profile. There's a compaction layer where your tillage equipment pressed the plowshare down on the soil surface, and that's compacting. And so the water only goes to that depth, starts to back up, anaerobic. Perfect breeding ground for diseases and pests. And of course, it leaches all of your nutrients out of your soil. Anytime you have enough water, that the water starts to move, it hits that compaction layer and it goes downhill. Bye. Where is that going to end up? In your rivers, in your lakes, and your streams, and we're destroying water quality. I like to point this little thing out to people. I won't eat oysters unless I know where those oysters came from. And the only place on this planet I know where the water quality is adequate is Nelson's Bay in New Zealand. Only if my oysters come from that place will I eat them. Otherwise, you're taking too big a chance. What have we done to water quality on this planet? And no wonder we have so many problems. We've got to reverse that. How do you reverse it? You get the biology back into the soil. You stop using inorganic fertilizers. Okay, that means you got to put organic matter back out there. Don't use cover crops. Oh, here we go. Another
might be a simple program.
Just antagonized yet another big group. Because cover crops, you have to go out and you have to buy the seed every year. And now you've got to put in the cover crop, you know, sometime in the after harvest of your last crop, and it starts growing, you know, winter happens, maybe the cover crop will start growing the next spring. And now you got to do something about that cover crop because we have not properly chosen the height on those plants because they're tall or taller than the crop plant we now want to put in. So how do you get rid of that cover plant or that cover crop? You're going to have to use an herbicide. Well, what do herbicides do to the organisms in your soil? It kills them.
I have no compunction about bringing in challenging topics, and so this could be a good one for a future discussion. But I would like to, I guess I would like to say that my sense is this is really, it's a challenging time, but it's a very exciting time to be involved in agriculture, because I mean, new ways of thinking, maybe some of those are derived from older ways, more traditional ways of thinking, are really getting a lot of attention. And I think that's for the more senior people like me, that's where you want to keep an open mind and listen to new ideas. And boy, it's been really interesting to have you on the program, Elaine. Really appreciate your time. And so Dr. Elaine Ingham, thank you again for joining us here on Questions in Sustainability, and hope to see you again.
Okay, I look forward to it.
If you'd like more information on today's topic, then go to our website. Our website, it can be found by Googling Questions in Sustainability. And thanks for joining us today.